of the unconscious. The dream doesn't tumble out the whole psychic repertoire that's been built up in my 41 years. If it did, I wouldn't want to go to sleep. It releases the images that tell me where I'm at now and whatever I need to know to deal with the next stage of the journey. And I shouldn't be, I think I said this in the first class, but I want to emphasize it. I need not go after more than that. And it's dangerous to go after more than that. It's dangerous to want to dig up the whole of my psychic repertoire in one, you know, fantastic psychic experience that just gives it all to me at once. That, I believe, is the danger of hallucinogenic drugs, LSD. They are an artificial release of the censorship. And that artificial release is a two-total release. And the result is an inundation by an overdose of psychic energy. And the ego can't take it. The ego's consciousness has to be, I would think, extremely self-possessed already for the person to profit from a hallucinogenic experience. An unhealthy person entering into a hallucinogenic experience is inviting schizophrenic breakdown. All right. Let me just indicate one other significance of psychic conversion, because it's important, and then I'll go into talking more about the dreams. In my own earlier work, for instance, if you've read or are reading Subject and Psyche, I approached psychic conversion from the standpoint of its importance for the fourth level of consciousness. Namely, values are apprehended in feelings. And feelings can be more easily identified by symbols. The symbols with which they're connected. One of the ways of being able to say to myself what I'm feeling is to grasp the symbol that somehow is connected with the feeling. So the release of symbols, for instance in dreams, gives me a way of grasping, identifying my feelings. And that way of identifying my feelings might be saying something about my response to values, or satisfactions, or whatever. Might be saying something about me as an existential subject, as a moral agent, because of this relationship of values, feelings, symbols. I made this hookup on the basis of some hints that Lonergan offers in Method and Theology. He doesn't make the hookup quite as explicitly as I do. Values, he says, are primordially apprehended in feelings, and I think that our experience bears that out. And then about 40 pages later, he says, he uses Suzanne Langer's definition of the symbol. Suzanne Langer defines a symbol as an image of a real or imaginary object that evokes a feeling or is evoked by a feeling. An image of a real or imaginary object that evokes feeling or is evoked by a feeling. So Suzanne Langer made the hookup between feelings and symbols. Lonergan made the hookup between feelings and values. Put the two together, you get a hookup of values, feelings, and symbols. And so paying attention to dreams tells me something about my life of feelings. And knowing something about my life of feeling, I know something about my spontaneous orientation as a moral agent in the world of values. You see the connection? So again, the way I originally talked about psychic conversion was in terms of knowing myself as an existential subject, as a moral agent at the fourth level of consciousness. Existential self-knowledge creation. Okay. I spoke there in the outline of the twofold significance of psychic conversion. First, dissolving the repressive censorship from resistance to willingness. We've certainly talked enough about that. The second significance, psychic self-appropriation. Through psychic conversion, that is to say, by coming into contact with the elemental images of my unconscious, I come to know my psyche. I come to appropriate my psyche. I come to tell my story. I come to psychic self-appropriation. I can appropriate the story of my ongoing engagement in the world by coming into contact with the images that are released by the unconscious. And I'm coming more and more to see that I can come to tell not only my own story, but the story of my time, of my period in history, of my culture, by that same process of coming into contact with the images of the unconscious. Why do I say that? Because the dialectic of history, what's going forward in history, sets the conditions for what's going forward in me. And so dreams can also function as a source of cultural criticism, sociocultural criticism. Clearest manifestation of this, one example of it, it's not the clearest manifestation, it's an overstatement. One manifestation of this. Jung relates how, when he visited the North American Pueblo Indians in New Mexico, and he started talking about dreams, and they were fascinated that a white man was interested in dreams because it had been part of their own cultural tradition and their own cultural history as long as their race could remember. But they said, you know, once the white man came, we started having fewer and fewer big dreams. The big dreams. They would make a distinction between the big dream and the little dream. And the big dream was a dream that really gave direction. It gave direction to the people, to the tribe, nation. What are they saying there? Culturally, they're making a very important statement. When the white man came, they began to take their direction less and less from themselves. They began to lose their own autonomy as self-directing people. They began to have fewer and fewer big dreams. Well, that's a cultural statement. It's a statement about what's happening to their race, to their nation, to their people. We began to find our direction less and less from ourselves and our own participation in existence. It began to be imposed on us more and more. So I think the dream can also function, and that's an example I'm trying to indicate there, as a source of cultural criticism as well, or at least what's going on in dreams. Because the cultural, the socio-historical situation is what sets up the conditions for what's happening in the person. I also think, and I just want to say this in the light of the symposium that we had the other night, where, again, Joe Holland was making the point that the experience of the poor is the hermeneutically privileged experience for theology. I believe that that statement can be grounded in the method that I'm using here, the transcendental method. I think it can be transcendentally grounded in this sense, that the hermeneutically privileged experience for interpreting myself is contact with the dimensions of my being that have been victimized by the dialectic of history. To come into contact with my own shadow, my own inner victims is a hermeneutically privileged access to the understanding of myself, without which I will not understand myself correctly because of the big block between consciousness and the unconscious. So in other words, I think that transcendental, this may be a little technical for some of you, but there's a criticism of Lonergan that his stuff doesn't go far enough to ground a liberation theology. And I think that possibly is true as far as he goes, but I think once you add the psychic dimension to the transcendental method, you can, in fact, ground transcendentally, that is to say, by an analysis of consciousness itself, you can ground the conviction of the liberation theologians that the experience of the poor is the hermeneutically experienced, privileged experience for theology today. Because the experience of my own victimization by the same forces that are focused in the poor and the oppressed, my own victimization by those same forces is the hermeneutically privileged experience of my understanding of myself. That's, again, as I say, a bit technical, but I want to relate this to the whole thing that they were talking about the other day. And then as far as narrative as foundational theology is concerned, I'm not going to go into that in detail. That's number six there. Except to say this, that through psychic conversion, I get in touch with my own story, and I begin to tell it as it is. No longer a cover story. I begin to tell it at least more as it is. And remember when we were talking about foundations in theology, ultimately, a person's theology is rooted in who they are, and who they are is rooted in their story. So foundations in theology is basically narrative. Coming into possession of the foundations of theology is done by coming into possession of your own story as a human being. That's the only point I want to make there. But the whole thing about what's the contribution of this theological foundations, I do a lot more with this in subject and psyche in the last chapter. But that's what I'm getting at. And the complementarity of the two vectors we've talked about already, so I'm not going to say too much more about that. The healing vector is for the creative vector. Healing releases creativity. So they're complementary that way. And they're complementary the other way. The creative vector needs the healing vector for itself, for its own dynamism to go forward. It needs healing. So each one needs the other. Healing without creativity, Lonergan says, is a soul without a body. But creativity without healing is subject to bias, the breakdown of bias. So the two are complementary to each other. Now that sets up the structure of Christian consciousness. Now, to get into dreams, and we'll begin the discussion in response to the questions that were asked earlier about the images and so on. We have only a few moments, but we can begin anyway. The first point that I want to make with regard to dreams is the one that I just made, and so I'm just going to repeat it. That dreams have a socio-historical setting. And so I'm convinced that we can push beyond merely personal psychological interpretation in dreams and begin to use our psychological knowledge as one instrument of cultural criticism. The dream, by telling me about my story in my world, is telling me something about my world. And so I can come at social criticism through the analysis. Next point on dreams, the varieties of dream symbolism. I think that there are at least three kinds of symbols that emerge in dreams. Jung distinguished two kinds, personal and archetypal. And he distinguished on that basis, two levels of the unconscious. The personal unconscious and the collective unconscious. Personal symbols are taken directly from the individual circumstances in a person's life. And they refer to those. The personal circumstances in my life, past or present or potential. It can be any one of those. Beings can anticipate the future. They don't just repeat the past. They don't just say what the present is. They can anticipate the future. But all the circumstances at the level of the personal unconscious are circumstances taken from the individual's own experience, whether that experience is available or whether it's been repressed. But, you know, the dream can show repressed elements of personal experience as well as elements that are available to me right now with relative ease. Personal dream symbols have no transpersonal significance to them. In other words, they're not telling a story that is somehow paradigmatic. Of the human story. They're just telling my story in relatively incidental details with regard to me. But they're not putting a mythic connotation to my story. The example that I always use on this, because it's one that's really clear. When I was in philosophy, studying philosophy in St. Louis, Pat Coffey, who now teaches at Marquette U, was studying with me there. I'm sure he wouldn't mind a repetition of this dream because it's not anything that whereby he would lose his authority. We had a course from James Collins, historian of modern philosophy, who is an absolute bear as a teacher. When I took his course, he had given 1A in the 3 previous years in the course. And it was an undergraduate course for which we had to take 4 very difficult exams and write 2 20-page term papers. And the chance of getting an A is about once every 3 years in the course. Collins was a polio victim, and so he was in a wheelchair. Now, Coffey and I were in the same class together. And Coffey had the recurrent nightmare of being chased by Collins in the wheelchair. And every time that he tried to get away from him, Collins would catch up to him. And he would try absolutely everything, like running down these stairs. Well, sure, he can't come down the stairs, and he gets to the bottom of the stairs, and there's Collins. That's pure personal symbolism. There's nothing archetypal about that at all. It's just a reflection of what's going on under these concrete circumstances in your life at the present time. Pure personal unconscious. Collective archetypal symbols, I'm going to go very quickly with this. Archetypal symbols are a deeper level of imagery, not necessarily derived just from the person's experience. But also, in addition to personal experience, filled with an emotional depth and a cross-cultural meaning that makes the dream more universally human. The dream is saying something about personal experience, but it's putting personal experience into the universal human drama. My niece, when she was 9 years old, had 2 dreams about 2 weeks apart. In one of them, she is standing on the edge of a body of water, and she has to go into the water, and she's afraid. The water here is a symbol of the unknown. It expresses a universal childhood experience. It certainly is expressing her experience, but it's expressing the universal experience of 9-year-olds. They're always venturing into the unknown. And in the next dream, 2 weeks later, she is sitting at the bottom of the ocean. She's gone in to the unknown. She's taken a plunge. She's sitting at the bottom of the ocean, and she is relaxed, and she's playing. She's playing with Lucille Ball. Whatever the fear was, it wasn't all that great. because playing with Lucille Ball, whatever the problem is, it's not serious. And there's a lid at the top of the ocean, a metal lid, and she knows she can go up any time and get out. Just lift the lid off and she can get out. And there's an octopus that comes along, and the octopus is playful. The octopus is a symbol of wholeness, a round, perfectly spherical sort of thing with eight legs, and they're all symmetrical with one another. Even as they twist and turn in symmetrical fashion, rhythmic fashion. She's taken another step towards her own integrated development. The octopus is a symbol of the integration that took place once she took the plunge. There's an archetypal significance there. That the water, for instance, is a universal human symbol for the unknown. It can be a universal symbol for something else, too, cleansing, drowning, whatever, but it's a universal symbol for the unknown, and the psyche of anybody from any culture would resonate to water as a symbol of the unknown, the depths. That's the archetypal. Anagogic, just very briefly. The anagogic symbols are symbols that are distinct from the archetypal. I'll say why in the next class. They are universally human, but they reflect the desire of the human person for a total transformation, for a release from the problem of evil. They are the universal symbols of the final human drama of good and evil. The eschatological symbols of the New Testament are anagogic symbols, not just archetypal symbols taken from nature, but anagogic symbols that point to God's total victory over the mystery of evil. Why I make this distinction will become clear as the course goes along. I just think it's an absolutely essential distinction. It's missed by Jung, and it leads to serious problems in his own thought, the fact that he can't make the distinction. Now, I'm sorry we didn't get further on dreams, but you see what's coming up next is negotiating dreams and dreams in the original experience, so we'll get us into that more in detail. Well, it's 2 weeks, you know, till the next class. Have a good Thanksgiving.